is a session led by Ralph Bolstad and Paul Bow. The subject is officially titled euthanasia, but I don't like that subject very well because I don't think that's exactly what we're going to be talking about tonight, although it may be a part of it. Euthanasia really means mercy killing, and I don't think that that's really what we're likely to deal with tonight. I should say a word about that. Back some years ago, when this subject and that subject was being talked about, not very often, one of our older pastors heard that there was going to be a discussion of euthanasia, and he turned to the fellow next to him and he said, "Why should we be talking about the youth in Asia? We've got plenty of troubled young people in this country." We're not going to try to do a lecture on the whole subject of when should people die or who makes decisions about when we die. I think all of us are quite well aware of the fact that given the amount of machinery and given the medical advances that have taken place over the last decades, it is possible for medical science to prolong life almost indefinitely. And this raises a number of difficult questions for not only medical people, but also for people whose life is being prolonged and their families and their friends. Many people, because of our ability in these days to prolong life, have been living a very lingering death. And many questions have been raised for all of us for that reason. What I would like to do tonight would be to raise a number of illustrations that from my own experience, and then I don't know what Ralph is going to say because he and I haven't really rehearsed together. We thought it might be better to allow this to be a kind of spontaneous thing. But I would like to cite a number of examples from our own personal life, and then ask Ralph to comment on whatever he would like to say, or whether he would like to cite some examples, and then open it up for our discussion and for our questioning. Carol and I have a friend, a very dear friend. They are people from Ames, Iowa, where I was a pastor from 1948 to 1952, and they were members of our congregation, and we've been very close friends ever since. 2 years ago, or a year ago last spring, in the early spring, they invited us down to Arkansas, where they live on the on Beaver Lake, which is a beautiful big lake down in Arkansas, and they have built a lovely retirement home on an acreage on this lake. They invited us down with another couple to go out with them on the White River in Arkansas. The White River is a big, fast river, and they had secured the services of a couple of guides, and we went out and spent a day on the White River fishing trout and just had a marvelous time together. And we've had some marvelous times together over the years. Well, he had a heart attack last year, and got over that fairly well, and then he had a slight stroke and seemed to be recovering from that fairly well, although it impeded his speech somewhat. And then he had a recurrence of his heart condition, and the surgeons, together with the family, decided that a bypass surgery would be in order. So he was taken to Oklahoma City, where one of his sons lives, and there was dealt with by cardiac specialists. A bypass operation was done, and something happened during the during the time that he was under the anesthetic because he has never recovered. And it's now been half a year, I think, since this took place. Carole and I visited there in Oklahoma City. He was still in the hospital last March. And he was not responding in any way, shape, or form. His wife was anxiously hovering over him and trying to get him to respond and telling us that he certainly was going to respond. We called just before we came out on this trip because we were anxious to know what was going on again. And she said that she thought he was getting better, but she wasn't sure, that the nurses had gotten him up on his feet, but he wasn't able to walk, and he's still not able to respond. Medically, the doctors don't seem to give much hope for him. He's being sustained, of course, by numerous therapies and medications and so on, but it's the kind of thing that I think is not uncommon at all with older people. He's, I think, 74 or 75 years old. So that's one circumstance in our life. Another circumstance, much more pointed in terms of what we're talking about here tonight, some years ago, one of the people who was on my staff at the National Office of the American Lutheran Church was the father of a 16-year-old boy. And the 16-year-old boy went out on a motorcycle one night. He hit something and flew over the handlebars of the motorcycle, lit on his head, broke his neck. And they called us, and we went out to the hospital. And they had put him on a respirator and all of the other kinds of machinery that sustain life. And when we got there early in the morning, the doctors had already told the family that there was not much hope for him. So we stayed there throughout the day. And late in the day, the medical doctor who had been talking with the family over the period of this accident came in while Carole and I were there and said that the boy was brain dead and there was no hope for him, but that he was on life-sustaining therapies and that they could keep him going as long, almost as long as they would wish. And then he said, he's healthy, he's young and he's strong and he's got good organs. There are many people at the University of Minnesota who are in need of his organs. Would you be willing that we cease treating him since he is already brain dead and when he does die to utilize his organs for transplants at the University of Minnesota? Well, they turned to us, of course, and wanted to know what we thought. And we talked it over at some great length. And finally, I said to the couple, I would certainly have no personal and moral objections if you told the doctors to cease treating him. But I said, I can't tell you what to do. And they decided that they should turn off the machinery. And the couple got into the car and went back to their house, and we sat there. And we sat there about 3 hours, sometimes in silence, but sometimes talking. And then the phone rang, and the doctor said, he's gone. But it was one of the most difficult kinds of situations in which I've ever been thrust to make that kind of a decision. Not that I made the decision, but at least to give my tacit approval to saying this is the time to cease treating. Last week we were here, and in the group was one of my college classmates. I hadn't seen her for a long time, and we looked at each other, a flicker of recognition came, and then she saw my name on the program, and she said, you're Paul Bowe, and I said, yes. And she said, I'm one of your classmates. And it turned out that we went to college together and graduated together. So we had a good time talking about the good old days and so on and so on and so on. And I asked her about herself, and she said she was a widow. And later on in the week, she came to me and she said, you know, I really want to talk to you about something that bothered me a great deal. And she said, you know, my husband had a severe cardiac condition. And his heart stopped on numerous occasions. And he was always rushed to the hospital, and they revived him by electrical means. I don't know, you know more about this than I do, but anyway, he was revived by electrical treatment of some kind, and his heart started beating again. Now, she said that this happened more than 30 times. Now, it's hard for me to believe that, but that they could restart a heart more than 30 times, but this is what she told me. But then she said it got to the point where he couldn't breathe anymore, and they had him on a respirator. And she said that he was then hospitalized permanently, and it cost her over $3,000 a week for his treatment in the hospital. And ultimately he died. And then she said that they did an autopsy on him and found, at least the doctor thought, that these many, 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 many electrical treatments had paralyzed the nerve that goes to the diaphragm, so that the diaphragm was no longer working, and then they kept him going with heart, lung, or with respirators. And then she said, should I have made a decision long before that they would do no more treatment on him? She said, his last months were just agony for him and for me. And she said, they've left us practically financially destitute. And she said, do you think I should have long before told the doctor not to treat him any longer? Well, I didn't know what to say to her. And I said, that's the kind of decision that only you and your husband can make. Well, this is nothing unusual. I'm sure many of you have faced similar kinds of situations, but those are three instances in our life that have faced us with this very difficult question of how should life terminate? And if we do have the power to keep life going, who makes decisions? Now later on, I have something to say about another subject which impinges on this, which is a living will. But I'd like to just leave it at that at this point and ask Ralph if he would like to make some comments at this point.
Well, we did see this from time to time in the hospital. We worked, both Rosemary and I, worked at the VA hospital. It was a psychiatric hospital in Knoxville. And oftentimes, well, we had the far-gone patient, the patient who had been psychotic, was now much better, or we had those who were brain damaged and were going downhill. You knew that they were going to die, that they probably weren't getting anything out of life at this point at all. One of the interesting and difficult things, or in one way, it made it easier for us because we didn't have to make this choice. Infuriated some of the relatives when they saw that the person seemed to not be appreciating life, not getting anything out of it, not recognizing them, if anything, suffering, and yet the regulations and the law did not permit us to pull the plug, I'll put in double negatives here now, not permit us not to treat with all the things that you were talking about. And even though the relatives said, hey, we want things to go this way now, depending on, some of us would say, well, we'll take the heat if, you know, for you. usually we tried to do it in a way that was in the heat. In the case of where you would have to pull the plug, as it were, I think one of the things you have to think about is, how will I feel afterwards? How guilty will I feel? By talking about it, by planning, by the two, for instance, husband and wife, or particularly talking about this beforehand, will put it, be a, give you a much better chance of not being guilty. I imagine that we would feel guilty in any case to a certain extent, but we, you know, it's something you can say, hey, I can't do this without feeling a little guilty, but it's certainly better for the my spouse or whoever it is, and they would really appreciate it. So that's one thing to think about, is what about the guilt that I will feel? Especially if it would be to your advantage. You know, if they're draining your all your finances away, and then you pull the plug, you'll say, well, now, was it really that I was thinking of him, or was it thinking of me? So you have to think about these things ahead of time. Because if you do, it'll be much easier for you down the road.
Ralph, could I ask a question? Mm-hmm. The fact that you were not able legally to do that, to cease treatment, was that because that was a federal institution, a VA hospital? Or I know that in some states, at least doctors do this, and don't seem to feel that this is a legal problem.
I think that it was mostly that it was a federal kind mm-hmm. of a thing, and yet the question, and the main thing they wanted to be sure of was that they weren't liable for suit, first mm-hmm. of all, and then, after all, the present administration is very much against any of this kind of thing. So your hands were very much tied.
I have one question. If they are on the, you know, life-saving thing, can you change your mind afterwards? You know, say don't. Let's say that they're on a long time. Couple of months or something, and you say, well, now this is long enough. Can you change your mind? I understood that once you've started it, you can't stop it.
That's one of the problems, but you could just as well be under under the hammer for not starting doing the treatment that is within your capability.
Well, I know in our case, the doctors and nurses decided at one time, you know, to move my son to another floor. Mm-hmm. And my goodness, it wasn't 10 minutes later that things start going back, you know, and my daughter-in-law threw one big fit. And boy, they got him back upstairs, you know, and mm-hmm. he did. And I know that he was in this hospital where they trained him. You know, big Lutheran General Park Rick, and bill was over $200,000, you know. And of course, there's quite a bit of insurance on a young man, you know. Besides, the hospital had to kind of step in, and then the union he worked for, but it really got into money that you wouldn't believe, and then she was left with three kids.
Did he survive?
No, he died after the 3.5 months on the machine. Mm. But he also wanted to be on.
He wanted to be treated.
He wanted to be treated.
Was he conscious during much of
the time? Well, towards the end, you could bring it, say yes, and you, but it's not true. Mm-hmm. I mean, you'd find him at a moment that maybe what you wanted to hear was yes, or what you wanted to hear was no. Mm-hmm. You know.
How did you know he wanted to be continue to be treated?
Because he always said when the doctor asked, could he take them off of this machine, him finding, you know, the kidney dialysis, he was getting that every day. Well, you can't do that every day for very long.
Okay. Yeah, okay, it's a real dilemma.
Right.
Anybody else want to contribute some ideas or thoughts or experience on this subject? Have any of you, of the others of you, gone through any similar experience or had friends who have?
Isn't it up to the family to decide what they want to do?
The what?
Well, yes and no, I guess. What do you think?
It helps to have it, but it depends on the state that you're in. And, of course, and it depends on how, what the, even the nursing staff, I mean, you're supposed to call up and say, hey, they're letting somebody, taking somebody off the machine, you know. And the feds are supposed to protect that person from the family.
Well, like my mother-in-law had cancer. She was 86 years old, and it was going all through her body.
Mm-hmm.
And they asked me at the rest home, did we want to take her over to the hospital and put her on all these things? And I said, no, let her die with dignity, and that's what she did.
I think you would be better off as far as the law is concerned there. You don't have to and again, it is better if, much easier if they aren't started on.
Mm-hmm.
Shall we talk about ourselves? If we aren't started on a machine, then it's much easier in the sight of the law. And if we refuse, each of us can refuse treatment. There's no question of that. The question comes when we are not capable of making that decision.
No.
That's what I was going to ask. If the person is brought to the hospital and is not capable of saying whether he or she was, is it just automatic that the hospital staff or doctors or nurses put them on, and then it later on to be, it becomes a question of do we pull the plug or not? Well, as you alluded to, it's much easier if they never get on it. But is there any way to keep them from being on it?
Your living will? Is that a possibility there?
Maybe this is the time to read this little article, because it's pertinent to what we're beginning to talk about here. This appeared in the Minneapolis Star and Tribune on the editorial page. It's written by Senator, or former Senator, Jacob Javits. I think most of us have heard of Jacob Javits, who was one of the foremost U.S. senators from the state of New York. And I think some of you are aware that Jacob Javits did not run for the Senate this last time, a couple years ago, that he was up for re-election, because he has incurred an incurable disease. Now, I don't remember what the disease is. I talked with Ralph about it. He thought it was what's called Lou Gehrig's disease. I thought it might have been Parkinson's disease. But anyway, Jacob Javits has apparently an incurable disease. And this is what Jacob Javits says. I may be terminally ill. I therefore face in an intimate and personal way the issue of my right to die. I am happy for those who are not ill, but they are terminal too. That's a statement that I think we all want to listen to. They are terminal too, and they should think about this question as it relates to themselves and those they love. The issue first received serious attention 10 years ago when a New Jersey court granted Karen Ann Quinlan's parents' request to remove life-preserving support from their comatose daughter. Since then, there has been an intensive inquiry into the ethical and legal aspects of the right to die. The issue is whether a terminally ill patient may confer the authority to withdraw his life support. This is generally done by means of a living will, written when the patient is still competent, that transfers authority to a designated relative, friend, physician, religious or legal advisor, or to the court, 35 states have passed living will laws, 22 of them in the last decade. And then there's a parenthesis put in by the editor of the Minneapolis paper, which says that Minnesota does not have such legislation yet, which is very interesting because Minnesota has always been such a state that's out in front on social legislation and hasn't passed that. The question arises in the case of any serious illness, including cancer, heart attack, and a range of neurological and neuromuscular diseases that deprive the patient of the ability to decide what is to be done for him or her. Once illness has struck, it is often too late. The patient is no longer competent to express a will. Birth and death are the most singular events we experience, and the contemplation of death as of birth should be a thing of beauty, not ignobility. Everyone must think about dying, young and old alike, though older people are at greater risk. Given new medical technology that can sustain life even when the brain is gone, we must also think about the right to die and the need for dignity in departing life. Happily, my mind is still functioning, but if it should stop, I believe I would be dead, and there would be no use in prolonging the agony. We owe it to ourselves and the ones we love to make provision for such moments. It is in the highest interest of humanitarianism that we prepare for those moments with a living will, with living will laws. Then he goes on to discuss the legal aspects of this and points out that a number of states do not yet, as in Minnesota, do not yet permit this kind of thing. Short of a living will, the best way to provide the dignity is to use the power of, provide that dignity is to use the power of attorney to appoint an individual to make medical decisions when the patient is no longer competent to make them. This is now legal in all states except the District of Columbia. Here again, the appointed person may be a relative, physician, or legal or religious advisor. And here, too, confusion and quarrels may be avoided by conferring the necessary authority in advance. This is where you designate a power of attorney to some trusted person who then, apparently by law, is able to make that kind of decision. Well, he has one more paragraph. There is finally the question of money, which plays a part in even this sort of decision. Many people were shocked last year when Governor Richard Lamb of Colorado urged people who have no real prospect of life to, quote, get out of the way, unquote, and stop using resources that could be used more profitably by other people. This sounds callous, and it probably was, but it was the truth. We have not yet reached the point, even in this glorious nation, where living or dying has nothing to do with economics. That is what makes the right to die with dignity an issue of morality as well as policy and law. Whether we are old or young, healthy or ill, we cannot go on shirking the question of who shall live and who shall die and who shall decide.
I don't want to you know, monopolize and be the last thing I say. But I have a living will. And I had friends sign it. And it, in my, the way I understand it is, should I be in an accident or sick, they do every single possible thing that they can for you. And when you're going to be terminal in a week or 5 days or 2 days, they don't put you on that machine. The only thing is this, again, your doctor may not go along with it, or maybe your relatives won't when you are in. I think the idea of a living will helps to make it easier for the family to know that that's what you would have wanted to have done, and you, they could live with it.
Okay.
I also have a living will, and I'm very strong for this, but I was in a meeting once before, so I've been here quite a while, and it is the point that that's not always a guarantee.
Why not?
Well, because as you said, it's not even legal in Minnesota, and the children, or whoever it is, could change their mind if the person that's in that state, and you're comatose, you don't know for sure if this person's going to carry it out.
It seems to me, I've read that even in the states where they're legal, it's not necessary for the doctor or the hospital to agree to abide by it anyhow. So I mean, it maybe makes the family feel better or something, but in essence, nothing has to be done that way.
I think Javits, in another paragraph that I didn't read, says somewhat similar, that living wills, it's difficult to make them absolutely binding because of the uncertainties. As Ralph has pointed out, even the doctors can't be certain.
One of the things I'd like to ask us to think about is, when do you die? Is it when your heart stops? Is it when would you be dead if your brain isn't functioning to stop your heart? Or is it, are you dead when you quit breathing? We didn't have to worry about it because any of these things meant that we would be physiologically dead in the past, but now with the idea of being able to breathe for you or have your heart work for you, it is a problem. When are you dead?
As a psychiatrist, what's your answer?
Well, my personal feeling is that if your brain isn't working, seeing that's my, as you say, I'm a psychiatrist, to me, a person is dead. But what do you people think?
I agree with you.
I agree with you.
May I ask the question? Can medical people ascertain for certain when the brain is dead, or if it is dead?
Any medical person who guarantees anything except that within 125 years you're going to die is a fool. You don't guarantee things, but you always run on chances, you know. There's one chance in a million that so-and-so will happen. It does one time in a million. So that's another problem. You know, you cannot have certainty. When it comes to your body, you can't have certainty. You've got to go on percentages.
In other words, what you're saying, and I think I am inclined to agree with you, is that even a living will would be very difficult to absolutely enforce, unless, as Javits says, you leave it to the court. And of course, in certain instances, this has been decided by the court, as in the case of this famous case of Karen Ann Quinlan, where the court did make a decision that the time had come to remove the life support.
She lived a long time after that.
Pardon?
She was alive a long time after.
Yes, almost 10 years beyond that, which I think illustrates exactly what Ralph has been saying, is that it's very difficult to predict, because certainly the medical doctors must have thought when she went on life supports that she couldn't live without them. And then she went on 10 years. But 10 years of coma. And 10 years that dominated the rest of the life of her family, which may or may not have been a good thing. You know, that's hard to know. Yes, do you?
Well, we too have signed living wills, but I think the main purpose of a living will is to take away the guilt feeling from your kids.
Okay.
Would not be hard at all for them to make that decision, especially if you've talked it up to them real good and long, and you really are adamant about it.
It's still their decision.
It's still their decision, but I think they can be influenced greatly by your personal conviction.
Okay.
And not just in writing, but letting them really know how you feel.
Yeah. Okay.
What way would you want to fly? I think that would go a long way.
Well, in some cases like that, I think children would almost feel
could even feel guilty if they didn't do it.
That's right, I hope so.
I'm interested in that power of attorney thing you mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
If you grant somebody the power of attorney, can you limit it to simply that and not meaning that they have a general power of attorney over the whole business?
I'm not able to ascertain that, and it's interesting that Javits has raised this issue. He says the authority conferred by a living will must not be abused. Nothing could be more important, after all, than the right to life and the right not to have it terminated prematurely. In the event of flagrant abuse or possibility of it, when a decision may seem to defy the wishes of the individual who made the will, or when loved ones are unable to determine if it should be invoked. there's a lot of fuzzy stuff here that is very difficult to deal with. He says the issue of living wills is now under consideration by the American Bar Association and the American Medical Association. So apparently they are working on this problem. We can only hope that they... and also the Committee on Aging of the Senate and the House of Representatives of the United States. We can only hope that they will all understand the need to preserve the dignity that is most precious to the older person or anyone else who has to think about imminent death. Surely that dignity is best served by avoiding the confusion that comes from not having a will about mortality. But I think the legal questions are very difficult to ascertain. I can't imagine that even a power of attorney in a case like this would be absolute. That would be very difficult for me to imagine.
Well, my impression part exploded, as I said before.
Yes.
And we took it to Stanford to see, to check it out and see what they could do. And they said the only thing that they could possibly do was to give him a new heart. And he said absolutely not.
Mm-hmm.
But he was coherent and could make that decision. And I was glad I did not have to make that decision.
Yes, yeah.
Because that is a very painful thing, and also it is very expensive. And he had made the decision, so I just abided by it. But I was glad I didn't have to make the decision and feel guilty. But as you were saying, in this case of giving somebody the right or power of attorney, there are so, I don't care what you ever do, there's always someone who's going to find a loophole and fall into it. And it may not happen in your family, and yet I know many, many people who have given their children their money, and, to take care of them, and then when the time comes, they just stick them in a home somewhere and forget them, all about them, and it has not been what that person really wanted. And it has not worked out well. I think I would think a long time before I would give anyone a power of attorney.
Okay.
I have no blood relation, and I have specified a certain friend as the executor. Should I also name her as I'm sorry, I had heart surgery. I didn't realize. I gave them permission myself, to operate. I had four bypasses. But what if this had all come up then?
That's what Javits is suggesting, is that it could be a friend to whom you...
I better take care of that.
In a living will, you could give the power to make that kind of decision if the situation comes up.
In a living will.
Mm-hmm. That's what he's saying.
That would take care of the medical as well as all the business anyway.
Right. An executrix probably is appointed to take care of things after you die. But this would be something that would be prior to.
Mm-hmm.
In case that.
Well, in case I couldn't handle the business affairs.
Yeah.
Too, and that would all work together, wouldn't it?
But even doing it to the court, what some of the courts do nowadays, I don't think I want them to happen.
Well, yeah, okay.
And these are the kind of things we should be thinking about.
No.
I was just gonna say, yes, you should give her the power of attorney, because that has happened to us, and my husband takes care of a friend of mine, been in a nursing home for 8 years and doesn't know what's going on, but she fortunately gave him power of attorney, so he's able to take care of her. And all the bills and deposit her checks and so forth. Without that,
Let me try this out on you. It, and theologically, it doesn't necessarily hold water, but I think in past generations, we were in the hands of God in a certain sense. The time of our life was really a part of the natural process, and certain things could be done by medical science, but not the kind of heroic measures that take place now. Most of the life-saving equipment that has come into being in the last decades is certainly man-made equipment. And so we really, in a sense, could almost say that we're, you know, that when we have been put on life-saving equipment, we're in the hands of man. Theologically, if we are in the hands of man, maybe human beings also ought to be able then to make, if they can make the decision to prolong life, maybe human beings ought to be given the right to terminate life. Now, theologically, I'm not sure where that stands, but that helps me a little bit to think through the problem. And I think it relieves some of the guilt that I might feel about that whole thing.
We lost five people on my husband's side of the family with cancer in 4.5 years. Mm-hmm. And if you've ever stood by and watched people mm-hmm. suffer, I think you have a right to make up your own mind what you want to do.
Okay. I think we have to recognize that we're talking about all of this here at Holden Village in the context of a faith that looks to life eternal. We're not talking about terminating something that ends everything. And to me, that eases a great deal the pain of making those kinds of decisions. When I think of my family and my loved ones, all of whom I know are people who have known Jesus Christ as their Savior and who trust in His promise of everlasting life. It gives me a different perspective on the prolonging of this life. I'm not so sure that I feel that this life is as, how shall I say it? I think you understand what I mean. I mean the prolongation of this life by heroic measures is not really necessary for me, as I view my loved ones and myself, in terms of my belief about the promise of life eternal. And I think we have to look at this whole business of the length of life and the termination of life as over against that kind of promise that God has given us.
I'm sure that man down in Florida that was arrested and put in prison for putting his wife out of misery feels the same way.
He probably did. I don't know. I don't remember reading in those articles whether he expressed anything about any kind of Christian faith or religious faith at all. Do you remember that? Now, I don't think we're here to try to give you advice on what you should do about this subject. We're here to try to raise up a subject that I think is pertinent and important for all of us to think about. Several of you have said that you have living wills, and many of us, I don't have a living will, and my wife doesn't have a living will, and I don't think my children do. But believe me, we're going to start thinking about that now. And I would like to suggest that if you think about this, that you do, that you consult three people about it. One would be your pastor, and talk it over with him, because there are certainly deeply spiritual aspects about what we're discussing here. The second would be your physician, and to discuss it thoroughly with your physician. And I hope you have a physician with whom you have a personal relationship and in whom you have confidence. And thirdly, discuss it with your lawyer, because there are legal implications. And once you have done that, dealt with the spiritual aspects of it, dealt with the physical aspects in terms of, and the psychological aspects in terms of your physician, and then the legal aspects in terms of your lawyer, I think that then you can make a wise decision about not only having such a will, but whether you should have such a will, but also the form in which it should take in relationship to the state in which you live and so on.